Welcome to the Creative Graphic Novels for Kids panel. Thanks everybody for coming today. And I'm going to introduce our panelists one by one. I'm going to try to go in order from left to right. If I make a mistake, someone please jump up and grab me. Okay. So immediately to my right is Jimmy Gowley. He is the cartoonist of the New York Times best-selling graphic novel series, Amelia Rules. Jimmy has 13 Eisner Award nominees to his name, including nods for Best Kids Comic, Best Single Issue, Coloring and Lettering. His book, Superheroes, won the 2006 Civil Award for Best Graphic Novel, and his work has been translated into multiple languages. His newest book, The Dumbest Idea Ever, a memoir about being a self-publishing teenage cartoonist, is due out from Scholastic's Graphics imprint in February 2014. This is Jimmy Gowley. Sheila Keenan, immediately to Jimmy's right, is an established author of nonfiction for kids such as Animals in the House, A History of Pets and People. Her latest titles include a picture book, As the Crow Flies, and How It Works Readers with David McCauley. She's a former senior editor at Abrams Comics Arts and helped launch the Scholastic's Graphics imprint. As a graphic novel editor, she has had the great pleasure of working with creators such as Kazu Kibuishi, Raina Telgemeier, Greg Roof, Dave Roman, Jason Shiga, Scott Morse, Jake Parker, Frank Camuso, and Jill Thompson, among others. She is the author and writer of the graphic novel Dogs of War, which comes out October 29th. Sheila's right is Nathan Fox. He is a comics artist and illustrator whose publishers and clients include The New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Wired, Mad, DC Comics, Vertigo Comics, Dark Horse Comics, Marvel Comics, Chronicle Books, Esquire, The Village Voice, and Rockstar Games, to name a few. Comics and graphic novels by Nathan include Dogs of War, previously mentioned, Fluorescent Black, Dark Rain, Zodiac, Pigeons from Hell, and DMZ Friendly Fire. He is the chair of the MFA Visual Narrative Program at the School of Visual Arts in New York, a new low residency graduate program in visual storytelling. That's... next we have Paul Pope. Paul Pope's comics have been seen since the 90s in series like THB and graphic novels like Batman Year 100, and in powerful shorter projects like His Strange Adventures, Sunday Comics, Homage from DC Comics. His work has won many awards, including the National Cartoonist Society's Reuben Award for Best Comic Book of the Year. In 2010, he was recognized as a master artist by the American Council of the Arts, and he is currently sitting on the ACA Advisory Board. His novel Battling Roy, a book-length epic featuring a young superhero for first, second, and third, yeah, just came out, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. On Wednesday.
On Wednesday. Thank you. And then just past Paul is Alexis Frederick Frost. He is the co-author and illustrator of the critically acclaimed Adventures in Cartooning series of graphic novels, a combination of a how-to book and an exciting adventure story. Adventures in Cartooning was chosen as a book list top 10 graphic novel of 2010 and received multiple awards. He also writes and illustrates the recurring comic Kit and Clay, published in the Phoenix Magazine in the United Kingdom. Alexis's illustrations have appeared online and in a variety of publications, including Nickelodeon Magazine, the Adventure Time comic, First Second Books, Tugboat Press, and others. A graduate from the inaugural class of the Center for Cartoon Studies, Alexis currently lives with his wife in Philadelphia. And Alexis, what is the title of the new book?
This is Adventures in Cartooning, Characters in Action.
Okay, Adventures in Cartooning, Characters in Action. And when does it come out?
It just came out. It actually came out on the same day.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, that's newly out, too, just this past week.
Just this week.
To his right is Andrew Arnold. He is also one of the co-creators of the Adventures in Cartooning series. Should we mention that there's a third guy involved?
He's not here.
His illustrations have appeared in several books from Roaring Book Press, as well as Cambridge University Press and Nickelodeon Magazine. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. And we won't mention James Stone, who's not here. And then, finally, at the end, is John Chad. John Chad lives in White River Junction, Vermont. He teaches screen printing and bookmaking at the Center for Cartoon Studies. His book, Leo Geo, was released by Boringbrook Press in March 2012, and the sequel, Neo Geo and the Cosmic Crisis, will be released this November. Which, do you know which day?
5th.
November 5. John Chad also has been commissioned to make mini-comics for Cartoon Network's Regular Show and Adventure Time. So, everybody's here. Well, my name is Chris Duffy, and I have some questions for these people. I want to show, because I'm not able to do two things at once, I'm just going to show some images from everybody's books. This is Adventures in Cartooning. This is from Battling Boy. This is the cover of Jimmy's book, which you can also see in real life right in front of him. These I took off Jimmy's blog. These are some pages from inside the book.
That's also my area, right?
What's that?
It's also my area rug. I think you can see
it there. Yeah. Oh,
I like that.
There's the cover to Dogs of War. There's an interior page to Dogs of War. And here we have the front cover to the next Neo Geo book. The back cover.
Yeah, I've got a
sort of the flip cover.
Don't mind that.
And that's my desktop.
That one.
So let's just ignore my desktop for the next hour while we talk about comics for kids. Okay, so here are the questions, starting with the question of longevity, or rather length of works. Comics usually start, or cartoonists usually start with shorter works, and certainly nobody does a graphic novel right off the bat as their first comic. And even the graphic novel medium is fairly new, so you know not that many people. There probably are people growing up now who are thinking, well, if I'm going to write a comic, it's got to be 120 pages, right? Because that's normal. But I don't think anybody here grew up sort of seeing that as the norm. Just in terms of getting started for a project this big, what comes before your first draft? What even? Let's forget about maybe the machinations of publishing, agents finding the logistics for getting it done. But what kind of thinking and preparation, research, and development come before your first draft starts for something this long? We can start with anybody, but who's got the longest book? I think Paul. No? Dogs of War?
208 pages.
220. Yeah. I'll go first.
Okay.
I think you have to think, what's the idea that I have that I can commit a year or 2 years to?
Right.
And it's not, it's athletic in a way. You know, you wake up in the morning and you're at that desk and you're going to spend, if you're writing and drawing it in particular, 10 hours that day in that world, and it has to be a subject matter that can sustain your interest at that level. Because if it can sustain your interest at that level, looking at the same page for 8 or 10 hours a day, it's certainly going to, hopefully, sustain the interest of a reader who's going to read that page in 10 seconds, which is sort of one of the depressing realities of cartooning. I took 12 hours to do that. It was the best 3 seconds of my life reading it. But I think that's the number one thing, just finding that idea that you can't let go of and you want to spend that much time in that world.
I mean, I would agree. For me, it wasn't so much the length, because I've written nonfiction books before that are long, but this is the first time I ever wrote a graphic novel. So for me, it was format and genre. I had never written a graphic novel, and I had never written historical fiction before. So, and I was going to take on 3 wars. So it was, I had to do an enormous amount of completely immersive research, I mean to the point of tears sometimes, just in the whole idea of these wars before I could actually come to the creative part of making a story for each one that, like Jimmy said, would sustain the interest of the readers. But yeah, because the reading experience was going to be a whole hell of a lot shorter than my research and writing experience.
Did you feel a responsibility to know a certain amount about each war, which you could read?
Well, I did, because I did. I felt a great responsibility because I'm a pacifist writing about war.
Right.
I'm a woman writing about male and boy characters in a very male war. And I'm also a white author writing about characters who are African American. So I felt this great responsibility to get everything right, like the slang, the clothes, the history, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to create these characters, to be honest. So, yeah. And then, of course, I'm a prose writer, so trying to go lean so that there was room for Nathan's fabulous art is rough. It's, every word is precious.
Anybody else want to address the question?
I also think, kind of on the technical aspect, and that's for me is interesting or always something to keep in mind working on longer work is really getting that character design down really strongly, because unlike when you're doing a short like 4-page comic or something, your skill set doesn't change that much between the first page and the fourth page, but often when you're going through a longer graphic novel, you're seeing at the end like, oh, I've really started to change the shape of this character, or it's sort of morphing as you go along. So it's something I do is to try to draw, you know, just a ton of the character before it actually starts getting into the book, so that I, you know, whatever that design is resonating with me, and I keep it consistent. So.
Yeah, I think that that like Alexis and I, maybe Nathan on them too, but you know, we were working together very closely on ours for like a year or two, so got to make sure we like each other a lot, right? So that was another thing that we kind of had to make sure we were good. But
I guess. Staying within the story and the character development, like actually getting into character every day. Especially like after all of that research and hearing all of these stories and trying, well, especially in terms of Dogs of War and you know, pacifism, not being a military man and all that other stuff, and trying to get your head in that and stay honest, as well as not going overboard and kind of lying to the viewer or lying through the character kind of notion. Jumping into that, I think every day is kind of the challenge. That, or at least that I face, to try and stay true to the characters without without taking too many liberties, you know, in terms of where the plot was going, you know, how the relationships between the characters are being handled. So that, which inevitably became the fun of, you know, working with you in the script and kind of bringing those characters to life. But that, at least for me, that was between three wars quite a juggle within one book.
It's a complicated question you asked, I think, but to boil it down quickly, I think at any given time you probably have 10 ideas for stories that you could do, and I find that I try to single out the one that I'm most obsessed with, like the one, as you say, like the one that you can preserve longevity for, and that goes for drawings as well, that, you know, a single drawing, and then after that it seems like it's just all about discipline, you know. Like, that's what I'm thinking about now, is just discipline. Like, what's it going to take, you know, to get this thing done?
I have two questions. One sort of for artists. Is it, you know, growing up reading serialized comics, the styles could change from issue to issue, and they often did as the artists sort of felt their way into it. And this idea of keeping it the same for 120 pages, do you feel like at times you want to change it up, like, just to keep yourself interested, like, find almost a new way into the story while you're in the middle of it? Do you feel a response, or do you feel a responsibility to really lock it down?
I actually think you can get away with a lot more latitude than you think you can. Okay. I think, you generally, you know, the guy with the S is Superman, and if he changes from page, nobody even really thinks about it all that much. One of the things I always do, which I used to think was terrible, was I draw it out of order. Uh-huh. So you don't actually see that progression through time. And I used to think it was awful and so amateurish of me. And then I found out that Jaime Hernandez does that. So now I just think I'm a genius too. So, you know.
I think for me, I had the opposite problem, because I had three stories, three sets of characters, and three different settings. And I wanted them to each be unique and unto themselves and authentic to the wars in which they were set. But there's certain things about conflict and military life that overlap, so I had to fight against having too much similarity from one to the next and make sure each of those characters remained unique. But for me, there's an equivalent to the character design, which is naming. I really can't get my story going until everybody's named. The dogs, the secondary characters, everybody. Once I have those names, I'm good to go. And I spent a lot of time looking at pictures of soldiers and dogs and then picked out ones that I liked and just actually hung them up all over the place. Thought about petting the dog and it, you know, it was cool.
I think I had an opportunity to get away with a lot because I really enjoy adapting my work to the stories so that the line work, the atmosphere, the mood, like everything kind of adapts or becomes the narrative as much as the story itself. So World War I is very sketchy and on location. World War II is very clean and cold because of its physical location. And then the last was a really great chance to jump between flashbacks as well as, you know, present time and, you know, in that era. And so it kind of allowed me to play with that. And especially in illustration work and definitely this, you know, I do what I can to try to fit the story as opposed to, you know, that kind of longevity. But I honestly think you can get away with a lot. And jumping around like that actually keeps it fresh. Because or at least for me, like I tried that in the past too. Because Guy Davis told me the same thing, and I was like, oh my god, if he does it, I can totally do it. But
you know, actually, if you want to know how much latitude you have in character design, if you look at like a 1968 Snoopy like Sunday page, and if he's on the doghouse lying down, and if he's at the typewriter, and if he's walking on all fours, those character designs have no relationship to each other. He couldn't actually move that way. Sometimes they're paws, sometimes they're hands, sometimes his back's arched, sometimes, and it's always Snoopy. No one ever goes, boy, he really lost me there in panel 3 because the paw was slightly angled weird. I mean,
yeah, it's just like marking your characters initially and like doing that footwork at the beginning. You know, you can start to play around with those designs. I have a flying saucer that just changes constantly, but it's like colored in such a way that it always identifies itself as a saucer, right. Even though mechanically it probably wouldn't work too well. Visually, it works just fine.
I'll get away from this idea of like how long these books are in one second, but I was just curious if there was just like, if you're like, your daily life just changed when you're doing something that long. Like, do you suddenly feel like, wait a minute, I didn't want a full-time job.
And then what kind of life?
I'm just curious if for cartoonists who've done, you know, work for anthologies and every week is maybe feels like a new project, is that, does that have an effect on you, the way you think about what you want to do next?
Well, I think for me, I've done a number of graphic novels, and so I'm used to this long-form workload, but I've been studying Disney a lot, like Disney technique, really relying on Ollie Johnson's book, The Illusion of Life. It has a lot of secrets about how you can efficiently get a massive graphic project done in an efficient way. And like I guess kind of at this phase, like this midstream of career or something, I that's to me become very important, you know, like how to quickly get the thing across. Because with Battling Boy, because he's like the two kid characters in the book are cute, and I find it's the hardest thing to draw because they're symmetrical. I guess cute kind of means symmetrical,
right?
You know, and there are certain liberties you can take, I guess, but that's the thing I find the hardest. All the grotesque characters are easy,
right?
But you know, like Don Bluth managed to find a way to make, you know, the little girl from Secret of Nim cute. There's right. Got to be a way to do it, right? So.
Sort of moving on to the question of your audience, a lot of cartoonists produce work for kids. Depending on where you start, sometimes maybe you've had the experience of not necessarily being able to get your work in front of kids without a lot of effort on your own part. Certainly small press and the traditional comics publishing meetings mean that if you do something for kids, you sort of have to make it your business to get them to read it. What's it like for those of you who started that way to suddenly work with a company that's got a lot of experience doing this? I mean, they have a point of view about how you get things for kids, what's appropriate for kids. There's an anything goes attitude towards all ages comics, which is a lot of fun in the direct market comic book stores. But it doesn't really, I don't know if it translates, just as an outside observer, does it translate to the world of, you know, Scholastic and First, Second, etc.? What's your experience been like in that regards? You know, and if you hadn't started in the direct market, what is what's your experience of publishers, you know, take on what is right for kids in graphic novels?
Can I talk about just what kids, like working with kids, like from the publishing side?
Okay.
Well, like I was thinking, as a creative person, or I do enjoy the part of the writing process where you do work with kids, or having the books, and, you know, at signings or at library visits or whatever, because it's there's no filter. It's a very direct response to what you're having. So it's almost like the best editor you have is the audience, because you can see exactly what's working and exactly what doesn't. And I think that helps me a lot with my writing, to sort of take away pretension or certain sort of artistic crutches or something that I have that you can't do when you're aiming at an audience of younger people. And I think that's a good lesson. And I also think, I mean, for me personally, I think this type of writing is what I enjoy doing. And so I don't think there's, you know, you don't sort of pull it back for children. I mean, I think that's the books that that kids are really drawn to do have, not an adult sensibility, but aren't playing down.
Sort of an intensity.
Yeah, they're still, yeah, because we all deal with this, similar things at different stages. But just my personality in general, I don't feel like I need to pull back from, like, something that's controversial, just because that's how I like. But I don't know about somebody else who has to turn it down.
I'm not necessarily even talking about controversy or toning themes down, but just sort of insights that maybe would never occur to you. But I have a question for you, Alexis. Do you guys test the adventures in cartoony books? Because they're very interactive. Do you bring them to kids before they're published?
Yeah, like informally. Informal testing.
Right.
Here. So James would have, you know, he has two daughters, so she would read them. I have nephews and family and things like that. So, but not like official sort of big tests.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it's, and then we do a lot of, like I said, library visits and a lot of school visits where there's a lot of direct interaction, because it is a drawing book, so we draw a lot. And so that's also really helpful to, you know, just sort of be kind of in the trenches and having fun.
When we started the Amelia Rule series in 2001, it's hard to remember what it was like. I was on a panel in San Diego, and like the question, it was about kids' comics, and the question was something like, well, why did you decide to go with the creator-owner? Why, you know, instead of possibly latching onto one of these licensed properties that are so popular right now? So, what are you talking about? In 2001, it wasn't that there was like an apathy towards kids' comics in the direct market. They were actively hostile to it. They did not want it. And you had to go find the kids, and you had to go to schools, and you still do, but even more so then. I remember really clearly, we had just put out our first trade paperback in 2002, I think, and debuted at San Diego, and I was sitting with Harold Buchholz, who now works for Archie Comics and worked with me at the time, and I said, hey, one of those little pieces of paper you used to get in school, like every month, and it'd have books to order from? And he's like, Scholastic Book Fair or Book Clubs? I said, yeah, so we need to like work with them. Goes, that'll never happen. but it did happen, and it's amazing for me to see where kids' comics have come over the last 10 years. It's unbelievable, and it's like the best of all possible worlds, because those publishers now, like Simon Schuster and Scholastic and First Second, they do have a viewpoint and an experience and a literary sensibility that's always been lacking in kids' comics, and it's amazing for me to be able to find a home with those people. It's incredible.
I mean, I would agree, especially because we're published by Scholastic. That's their business. They know the kids' market more than anybody, and graphics was the first line of graphic novels solely for kids. So So they really know where it's at. And I think as a creator, it's like creating anything. You're thinking about your audience. I mean, I don't want a kid to be so immersed in my Vietnam story and really digging it and going along with the soldier and the dog, and suddenly they just stop reading because they're like, wow, what's humping the boonies mean? Because they don't know. I don't want them to get lost in my story where they shouldn't be lost. So I worked really hard to provide context for that kind of language or situation so that it would keep the story first and foremost for them. So I think if you think that way, you come out with a true story the same way you would writing for anybody, really.
Before I started doing children's books, I was really inspired by artist books, and I worked a lot with mini comics, and I did a lot of them as these series of like formal experiments where you read in different ways, like unfolding or reading against the reading flow or turning the book upside down. And I really made them as like a series of conversation starters with adults I thought I was going to have these conversations with. And I just thought that they would be the ones that I would be talking about, like how a book is read, what makes a book. But then when I started adapting it into a children's book, I found that children were just as excited to have that conversation. They were just as willing to like interact with the book. And it was just something that I didn't expect was going to happen. It's not that I like wasn't making it for kids beforehand. I just didn't think that they would want to engage in that sort of like level of interaction with the objects.
Right, your book, in case anybody doesn't know, is every spread is a continuous environment where you follow a figure's journey. Is that a good description?
Yeah, there's no panels, it's just one continuous illustration, then you flip the book upside down and you read up.
Right.
If you told somebody to like turn a book upside down and read up, you know, a lot of people just wouldn't compute.
Sure.
But
sure.
But I find that like kids are actually more ready to do that than adults, and they're more ready to like engage in those sort of different reading experiences.
Right, everybody's had the experience of handing a comic to, you know, their parent, and that they've made, and they just sort of hold it, and they don't know where to start, or, you know, they're looking at it upside down for the wrong reason. John, were you surprised? Is that sort of interactivity? Because my experience at Nickelodeon Magazine was that kids were kind of longing for that kind of thing. They like to do stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a comic that engages them, it is always going to be a win in many ways. I mean, you were surprised by that. Do you feel like you've taken advantage of it more going from book one to book two?
Yeah, I feel like you can play around a lot more with flipping the physical book over, turning the pages, reading in different directions. It's actually adults that are more not willing to go against the reading flow than kids. They're willing. You know, an adult will like tilt their head
right.
and try to read it, but the kid will just like take the book and flip it over.
Right.
Yeah, I think that also at least translates into what I thought, you know, because when we first started talking about this project, I'm like, like dogs and kids, like, what am I going to do? I just, you know, like, I just got done working on a book for Heavy Metal, and I'm doing these illustrations that deal with very serious issues and political issues, and, you know, like, how am I going to translate any of this? And I have two daughters as well, and, you know, I started realizing that even the conversations we were having and the things that they were reading, like, there was nothing I really had to dumb down or adapt. I mean, they're very smart, you know. Like, I realized that no matter how open I thought my perception was as to what, you know, children were open to, you know, in reality, they're much more savvy and willing to engage than, you know, I ever really thought. So I just started doing sketches and had a couple of conversations with my daughter. She's like, yeah, that's cool. Dog's cute.
Right.
You know, and then it kind of went from there. And so, you know, just staying outside of complete, you know, gore and things that I'm used to, and grotesque
right.
characters are very easy, you know, and like awfully fun. But, you know, to really kind of house that and actually perpetuate a story, you know, with that type of language without having to dumb it down was very, very encouraging and very freeing. Because then it really just came down to a great story and just kind of let it flow and see what happened.
Paul, I'm curious, I don't know that you've done work that was aimed overtly at kids before. Was it something that you were eager to do, or were you looking for a place for that kind of story? Or just, I'm curious what your relationship is to the audience.
I guess yeah, I think this is even though my science fiction book, THB, is probably for teens, I would say. It's nothing, it's PG-13 pretty much. But I sort of identified a lack of comic books with kid superheroes, and I haven't approached Battling Boy any differently from how I've done any of my other books. It's just that I kind of had a rule for myself, like I'm not going to interject myself as the author and draw myself in there, and we'll put Osama bin Laden as a bad guy, and, you know, there won't be any swearing or drugs or anything like that, you know. I think the advantage of working with one of the big six is, you know, like First Second actually has the marketing machine that can actually get this into the hands of kids. And it wasn't like my editor Mark sitting over there. We have been on the road for the last week meeting hundreds and hundreds of kids, doing talks in school libraries, public libraries, schools, having, you know, Subway sandwiches with 17-year-olds asking questions about their career. And it's every, so we've been meeting everyone from like 10-year-olds to high school kids, and then when we do public school libraries or book signings, it's all ages. You know, like, you know, guys in their 60s who've read Silver Age comics picking up this book and like getting all the kind of Jack Kirby stuff in it. So I'm just really glad that, you know, doing just what I would have done anyway, even if nobody bought it, you know, it's just the marketing machines behind it to actually get it in the hands of the people who do want to read stuff like this. So in that sense, it's very refreshing because it means that it doesn't have to be another, as you were saying, another licensed kid, another Spider-Man comic book where once again, he, you know, the Green Goblin once again, you know, that kind of thing. It just gets tiresome after a while.
Right, right. I read somewhere that, or actually I think an agent told me that all, that the sort of rule of thumb these days, and I could be wrong, Sheila, you probably know more about this than I do, is that a children's book has to star, these days, if it's for middle school or high school, has to star a child or feature a child of the age, you know, for the intended reader is. Which seems like, you know, a broad statement, but of course there are exceptions to it. But do you find that there's something to that, that in terms of the kids reading a book that's they want to see themselves in it?
Yeah, I think that's true, that a lot of the graphic novels and publishing in general for kids is often within the age range or a little higher, because kids like to read up, nobody likes to be 10 and reading a book about a 7-year-old. So yeah, that is something to consider, and it can be tricky, because in my book, they can't be kids.
Right.
They got to be old enough to be in war. So, but in war, you can be kind of young, like 16, 17. So I just made one character lie about his age.
Right, which was common in World War I.
Yeah, it's very common, and actually my father did it in World War II. So, you know, there's certain limits to that, but then often the content will have an interest level unto itself. Like, for some reason, kids really love World War II still. I mean, maybe it's because it's still considered the Good War, something that had clear objectives. I mean, it's the reason I wrote that one last, because I thought by the time I finish the Vietnam one, I'm going to be so depressed. I'm going to need, like, a so-called Good War. But, you know, just because they're not in it doesn't mean they won't be intrigued by it, but you have to find a way in. And that's why I chose the dogs, because the relationship between dogs and soldiers, kids are very empathetic to animals, right? That's a very primal relationship. This animal loves you above all else. It's totally loyal. And you're going to put it in this dangerous situation and be responsible for it when it's saving your life. You know, the whole thing, I thought that was a really good entrance point for kids to look at the complexity of war, because it's complex. So, yeah.
I actually think the age for the protagonist thing should get a pass in comics.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't know anyone who goes, well, Calvin's 6.
Right.
So I'm not going to read Calvin and Hobbes. And how old is Charlie Brown? I mean, nobody knows. I think there is something, especially an iconic child cartoon character, that can stand for anybody.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a little whole, I understand what they're saying in a chapter book sort of situation. I think that's sort of still carried over. But I think I vote for comics getting a pass. Who's with?
You just don't put the number. Just don't put the number or the grade, and you're good. Could be any age.
I tend to get really mad when editors have this formula. They tell you it has to be like this. This happens in film all the time. Like Robert McKee said, a film must be a 3-act structure. Why? Like then you're just asking for it. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to come and break it if you tell me. Because the first thing I'm thinking is Bone. Bone isn't even a human being. That's sold 20 million copies. Every kid in the world knows what Bone is. You know what I mean? So, I mean, if you make comics, you know, then you can demonstrate the formula.
Right.
But the editor is just going to come in and tell you, well, you can't do that. You mean this kind of thing. You can't stand it.
The, Yeah, no, as a kid, I read Archie. Oh, he's a cartoonist. Not when I was a teenager, that's for sure. But I know people who think the teenagers read Archie, and all I can think is, what planet are they on? does anybody else want to jump in there? I'm curious about the Adventures in Cartooning guys. You guys have to work so hard to make those books include the reader. Which is true of all books, but yours in particular. Have you ever found yourself thinking maybe we're going to lose the reader with this one? Like, they're not extremely directive. I'm always surprised that your books don't say, you know, oh no, now we're at the castle.
Draw the castle.
You know, like it's much more indirect than that. I mean, how do you find that balance where you're stringing the reader along, but you're making them sort of think about what's going on?
Well, I guess I always like to think that you can give kids a lot more credit than you think. You know, that they're pretty smart, and that you give them that credit, then they're going to make, I mean, they might see what you're wanting them to see, or maybe they'll see something else. It's like, it's all kind of an interesting experiment, like Alexis was saying, like sometimes, when we go to do these school visits, and the things that you hear from these kids, it might be something completely, like, different than what you expect. And that's like, I mean, it's awesome, right? Like, you learn something from them that you didn't, that you were trying to, like you're trying to teach them something, but they're like teaching you that it's more than that. It's like, it's cool. And, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what I pretty much think, like you.
Yeah. And then we sort of specifically really tried to stay away from the now draw a castle, now draw a thing. I mean, that was sort of, we really wanted the story to be at the front of the book, because we're all storytellers, and that's what we really, you know, feel is the heart of any good comic or any story. So we really tried to do that, and I think, we are not too worried about losing the reader, because we do have good editors that tell us, like, hey, what's happening here? And then also, I think that puzzle or that like little surprise, like, oh, this is telling you something, is actually part of what's cool about it, is the discovering that little thing, or sort of learning about it by sort of experience it, as opposed to somebody sort of up lecturing you how to do it.
Yeah, I enjoy how the character design theme is throughout the entire book, but it's never pointed out until the very end, but it's not pointed out in conjunction to a lot of the characters who were demonstrating principles, which I thought was really, it's really nice. It does give kids something to discover kind of as they go, to go back and look at them.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, a lot of, at least me, when I was, like, learning how to draw or stuff, it wasn't the card, like, this is, you take a circle and a, like, you know, make like a little thing out of it. It was like, hey, let's look at this crazy, like Kirby comic and be like, all right. Try to draw a bicep like that, or try to draw big square fingers, you know. So it was discovering. I mean, that was how I learned, and I think a lot of people learned. So it's, I'm going to try to capture some of that within the book.
I think it was mostly about enthusiasm. Like, it was never a question of whether I was going to make Leo Geo as a doctor, like a little kid. Like, he was always going to be an adult, but he could still have that voice and that enthusiasm that kids take to the same subjects. Because if he's going to talk about, you know, uphill landslides, which is called a strudstern, or like other really, like, maybe not as exciting geology facts, like, he's got to be pumped about it. He's got to be really, really pumped. And I just really just happened to that, you know, that place where we all were excited about drills and the earth. And if you can capture that again, I think that I can get away with having these kind of older doctor characters if they exhibit that same excitement that a kid would have about a drill tank or a 12-headed monster.
Yeah, so he's like a stand-in kid, but not a kid.
Yeah.
So we have about 20 minutes left. I thought I'd ask one more question, and then we could open up to questions if anybody has questions. Unless there's something anybody wants to bring up over the past topics. All right, going to the last question. Last question being kind of the fun one or the cliched one, depending on your point of view. But influences. People want to know, what would you say is or are the biggest influences on your work? And if you had to say what tradition your latest book is sort of a part of, like when you see other books, you know, and you sort of think, oh, that's kind of like this book, or that's one I owe something to that book, or sort of part of the same tradition. So that's part one. Like, what are your influences in regards to the current book, and also what comic or novel or graphic novel influenced your work that you think everyone should read? We won't. It's not like a big. No one's going to be punished for not reading it, but just encourage them. Let's just go straight to it.
So, my favorite artist of all time is this book artist named Julie Chen. She works out of Berkeley, California, and she runs Flying Fish Press. She does these amazing artist books that really challenged how I approach the book, how I approach page design and interactivity. I'm completely in love with her work. And then there's a genre of Japanese television movies called tokusatsu. It's like the big, the Power Rangers and the Godzilla and stuff. And I've just always been really inspired by designs and the creativity and the action and the themes that come with that genre. So those have kind of been really influencing me on a writing and construction standpoint. And for drawing, the Where's Waldo books, you know, all those little details, the guy that did Full Moon Soup, just when, you could say the plot of a Waldo book very easily. Waldo travels through time and he loses his stuff. That's the plot of a Waldo book. But on each page, you're bombarded with all this visual information and all this fun that allows you to kind of fill in the gaps on what's happening, on a more detailed level. And then if I can have one book, Morningstar by Kaz Strepek is this wonderful. There's two volumes of the graphic novel out, and it's this fantasy story. It's an adventure. It's really, really good. Really good world building.
Andrew.
Well, I'm kind of maybe a little bit of a cliche because I grew up reading, Marvel Comics and things of that nature, and I love that stuff, and I would say that, Jack Kirby and all that, those artists of that generation are the guys that kind of spoke to me, and I do think that sort of, crazy world, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created back then is kind of apparent in these stories, how they're kind of wacky and all these weird things happen, within their worlds. And so I think it's kind of weird how it translates in a way that obviously you don't maybe see visually, but it's there. That's really my primary influence, I would say. And then, but now I work in children's books also. I'm a book designer, and so I'm surrounded by immersed in kids' books, picture books. And maybe it's because I work there, but one book that has really influenced me since I started working there was My Friend Rabbit. It's this picture book about this little rabbit that kind of causes trouble, and it's very punchy, and it's just masterfully crafted, and it won an award, and I think about how it's the rhythm of the story adds to this really easy going sort of thing, but it's this really, he causes so much trouble and wreaks so much havoc, and it's just told in such a wonderful way, and that's my one book that is really, I would recommend.
Okay, well, I think a big influence on these books, and Andrew said this in the hallway, was Ed Emberle's Make a World, yeah. Where he has a ton of those where you just make little characters out of different teeny tiny shapes.
Is that book still in print? It is? Because I see all his other books, the Red Book, yeah, the Orange Book. I just haven't seen that one in the stores.
I think it is.
How to draw step-by-step books.
It's really graphic characters. So that's a big sort of influence on this. I also like the Richard. Is it Richard Scarry?
Scarry.
Is it Scarry? Yeah, that's the answer.
There's two R's. I don't know how to say
it. Richard Scarry's books were. I mean, I loved those when I was a kid, and it's always cool. It's similar to the Where's Waldo things. There's always a story in your book. There's always crazy stuff going on, and there's little things happening in the background, and I try to capture some of that in these books, that even in the background there's something interesting happening. I think that comes through in the character book a bunch. And the thing I would suggest every kid read is the Moomin by Tove Jansson. Is it that pronounced correctly?
Sure.
I know how to say their name. Because those are just, they're so just creative, such a clear vision, amazing character designs, amazing variety of character designs. It's just, I think that's a great book for anybody, for like young cartoonists to look at and just see a really distinct vision and just amazing pages, super creative stories. I think it's a good one.
Thanks. Okay. I name Jack Kirby all the time, so I'm another Jack Kirby fan. And I think it's apparent if you read Battling Boy, but I also read Heavy Metal magazine when I was a kid growing up, and so there's a lot of like French and Italian cartooning that I threw into this. Basically anything I thought of that I was into when I was 12 years old, you know, like that kid, like if he had the skill of an adult to draw comics, like what would he want to do? And now that we're talking about it, this is super obscure, but in Heavy Metal magazine, there's a Spanish artist named Daniel Torres who did a series called Rocco Vargas, and it's just this space adventurer. But it had a real, like a 1940s Frank Capra, you know, like, the Universal 1930s serial Flash Gordon feel, like this really elegant story, like classic science fiction stuff. But also, the drawing was really very particular. It's hard to describe it, but it's very colorful and very specific. And I loved that as a kid, so I've always had that in mind, even though Battling Boy is very different from Rocco Vargas. Like, sort of in spirit, it's similar, you know?
It's really gorgeous, yeah. Yeah, I can't stop looking at those pages when I see them.
Yeah, he now has a TV series called Tom in Spain that's about this giant orange dinosaur.
Oh, I've seen like, the comic.
Yeah, he's a comic as well.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I guess I couldn't really go to Calvin and Hobbes for this, but I would have to say that was probably my only, that and Garfield, I think, were my education as a kid in comics. I didn't really get into comics until college, and discovered Marvel and DC and everything there outside of, you know, cartoons and the Justice League. But Kniff had a really huge effect on me, and I can't get away from Terry and the Pirates, as well as UKOA Prince, Taizo Yoshitoshi. A combination between his printed works and Milton Kniff, I think, were some of my biggest influences. I can't get those characters and that line work and those blacks out of my head. I guess I would have to go with Calvin and Hobbes for the recommendation, just because there is action and punishment. Within there that I identified with as a kid. So in terms of being free, but also repercussions of being responsible, I think that was a good one.
Pretty universal.
Yeah.
I guess my influence is really, might not even show in this book, but the first big influence for me, probably because it's the first big series I read, was Love and Rockets. Because I think just nothing beats that for the richness of character and just the human relations between it. I mean, I just love the storytelling in there. But the book that most influenced my thinking in here, though it's not anywhere near the tradition, is Barefoot Kim. If you haven't read it, it's a multi-volume series that's set in Hiroshima right before, during, and after the bomb is dropped. And there's just something about the way that series works where you already know what's going to happen, and yet that you're still completely engrossed in these little details of daily life, daily humiliations that are going on for the characters who are trying to stand up for the right thing. And then this bomb drops, and you're overwhelmed by this horror of it, but I can never forget the people being so thirsty. And so I really liked the way that it made you think how war really, really works, and what is the price that you are going to pay for this.
The attention to details
and the level of humanity of those details is really what made a big impact on me. It's what I'm trying to do with this story too, so that you're thinking about the cost of this and is it worth the price you're going to pay. So that would be it.
Bring it on home, Jim.
All right, bring it home. Round and third. So I learned to read with peanuts. Like peanuts is my DNA. I know it inside and out. So that's way, way, way at the top. And when I was 14, as you can read in the upcoming Scholastic book, The Dumbest Idea Ever, I was in a not great place, and I got to go to a comic book store, first time ever in my life. My dad took me to a comic book store. I'd been sick for a month, and I was just dying, and everything was bad. he took me to this comic book store, and I went in, and I bought Love and Rockets, and I bought Cerebus, which is deeply unpopular now, but at the time, it was an answer to a prayer for me, like, quite literally. And so those things, I mean, Jaime Hernandez, I think, is a genius beyond all geniuses, and but Dave Sim is there, too. He has deeply offensive, I guess, political positions, and that makes his work sort of forgotten in a way. But it's a textbook on how to create the best comics ever. Every part of it is great, even the parts that aren't great, because it will teach you something. It's fantastic. I love it. And as far as a book, you know, this sort of is, it's about me coming into my own as a writer and an artist, so it's a long tradition of books of young men becoming artists. So, and I've read a lot of them, and I hate all of them. All of them. Because it's always, I'm the lone suffering artist saint, and I live in a town of cliches, and they all hate me, but I, with my vision, will change the world. And I think it sets up this sort of myth of the artist as being different and outside of everybody else, and I think that's destructive, and I think it's particularly destructive to the artist. So I wanted to
Your friends kind of destroy that idea in the book.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
the whole scene dealing with that.
And it was the best thing that ever happened. You know, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I think that's destructive mostly to the artist. So I wanted to do the opposite of that. So if there's a book I can recommend along the lines of what your life would be like if you wanted to be an artist, it's Harriet the Spy.
Oh, yeah.
That is a great children's book, and I think that tells you everything you need to know.
I think we only have time for a couple of questions, and they should probably be aimed at individuals. I don't think we have time to go down the line. Yes?
Well, my question is for the one person who wants to answer this. sorry about that. There are a few things that you can do in adult comics, you can do in kids comics. I'm thinking of excessive language, nudity, violence, those kind of things. What are some of the things you can do in a children's book that you can do in an adult comics? So, whoever wants to answer this.
Who wants it?
That's a great question. Yeah. I'd never considered it.
You can be hopeful. You can, because a kid is nothing about hope. A kid is up. When a kid walks around, they're looking up. Everything's new. And when you're an adult, to give hope, everyone assumes it's false hope, because they've already made their bad life choices and are in a cubicle. Can't believe that there's something else. So that's what doing kids' book is. You can give them hope. That's not false.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would say The Dogs of War is very authentic as a war experience, but even I could not bring myself to kill one of those dogs. And I think maybe in an adult book, somebody would say, there's three stories here, one of those dogs would be bound to die. But a kid is going to be like, Loki made it, you know? So, yeah, it does give you hope, which is, you want to give them hope. They're kids.
Yeah. Did you want to add something
to Oh, I was just going to say, I think it gives you more freedom to be more like crazy creative, you know, and like you can have animals that talk, and you can have like look at how creative kids' books are, and just there's just so much that you can explore, and a lot more sort of I don't know if it's humor or fun or something like that. It's something about just having more fun, and it's related to hope. Just kind of more jubilant or whatever.
Yeah.
You can have.
Jubilant,
even
yeah.
even
you
really
can be,
tough.
You can
things.
Be playful without having a reason. Really.
Right, right. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have a question?
Acknowledgements, see who the editor is that's being thanked, and then shoot them an email.
That's great. I think, yeah, talking to people who you have a natural connection with because of the work they're doing might have something in common with yours. That's a great way to start. I think we have time for, but there's two questions. Let's do it real quick. One here and one here.
Okay, so whoever wants to answer this, you guys are writing for children, kids' books, or comic books. Do you kind of write the mentality sort of like a children's picture book, or do you try to abstract and not have as much dialogue as, let's say, a mainstream Marvel comic, or more like dialogue heavy stuff? Because I'm a cartoonist as well, and that's something.
I think it depends on the project. Is that, is that accurate?
Yeah, because of the facts in my book, I have a lot of nonfiction facts. I try not to, you know, put them and say anything false, and I don't want to pull my punches semantically. And then we were talking earlier about, like, kids are just going to take what they're gonna enjoy, and so they might not get all the facts on the first read, but that's something that will evolve and they'll learn to enjoy over time. But I know that that way of approaching it is completely different than how, like, Adventures in Cartooning, because that's much different. It's a much different voice.
Sorry. Yeah, I think it's just, like, finding the voice. I don't like a lot of dialogue and a lot of things I read in general. Like, I like things very succinct and short, so that's sort of just how I feel it. But, I mean, it's, yeah, I think it is actually related to your voice and sort of the images that you have.
So yeah, some people can make oodles of dialogue work really well.
Right.
You know, you can read Barnaby and just get lost in the dialogue.
Or like Tintin or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Tintin. Yeah. One more question. Last question. Was there one over here? There's going to be a signing at Autograph Area 21. I think some of the people on this table are going to be there. Of all or some?
And some of
the books are free.
Free books.
Okay.
They're not even available.
And that'll be right now. It'll be in like 15 minutes. But
21.
And it says time's up. So thanks everybody for coming.